This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street all across North Dakota. And it's the last day in July, so it means it's time for a journalist roundtable to talk about the stories that have been making headlines across North Dakota for the past month. And of course, this is the most bizarre year I can remember in my lifetime. Dave Thompson is our news director at Prairie Public. He's a regular on our journalist roundtable. And also joining us today, we've got Steve Wagner, director of Forum News Service, and Robin Huebner, investigative and enterprise reporter at Forum Communications and WDAY-TV. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Robin, always a pleasure to have you back with us.
Thank you, Doug, and always a pleasure to talk with my former co-worker from way back when.
That's right. We used to share an anchor desk a long time ago. Let's start, Dave, with the newest numbers from Danielle Webster, the novel coronavirus cases in the state.
How about that? 168 new cases reported today from 29 counties. And, you know, a long time it's been Cass has been kind of the hot spot, but Burley has well overtaken Cass. As a matter of fact, the number of cases that are active in Burley right now are about twice what they are in Cass, which has been an interesting turnaround.
The other issue here is that the governor, who's been warning everybody to wear masks, to socially distance, to follow the North Dakota SMART guidelines, is concerned, Steve, about the spike that we've been seeing in COVID-19 cases.
Yeah, I think the governor has come out and urged people in the strongest language that he can time after time, though he has repeatedly said that, you know, there wasn't going to be a mandate. So, but we've seen these numbers creep up. From my count, you know, 12 of the last 15 days, we've had over 100 COVID-positive cases in the state with a new record set today. So it's interesting. This is the time of year where everybody wants to get out and do things, and we've seen a wide number of counties reporting positive cases day after day.
He's concerned that North Dakota may have to start shutting down a bit, like states in the Southwest and South, Arizona and Texas, that reopened widely and have suffered just staggering numbers of cases of COVID-19. Robin, you've been, you know, covering this story and many others, but no story in my memory has ever been so pervasive, so wide-ranging, so deep as this pandemic. When you look at the kinds of things you've been reporting about, what sticks out in your mind?
Well, first of all, Doug, I totally agree with you that it is astounding to be witnessing this and being a part of this. A friend of mine said, when I was telling him how concerned I was about this pandemic, he said, oh, think of it as history. You know, you're experiencing part of history. Well, you know, I don't know if this is a part of history I ever imagined. But and it's sort of discombobulating, too, I have to say, a little bit as a journalist working from home. You know, you're used to being connected to coworkers and to people and being able to see people. And it's just very different. But I guess what sticks out to me today, what I would say sticks out to me the most today, is how unbelievably political a contagious disease has become.
Yes.
And divisive. It's just, who would have thought that we would be shunning scientists and we would be, you know, just believing some people believing things that they just read willy-nilly off social media above what scientists have said for a long time about an infectious disease. So that, to me, I just cannot really understand that, and it's frustrating.
It's confirmation bias sort of unhinged. It's
right.
Crazy.
Right.
The way things are going on. And we've only recently had the leader of our country, the president, come out and very strongly advocate wearing masks, which is something that he had
you know, sort of eschewed, at least in his own personal relations, and now kind of backtracking. It's strange how this political ping pong ball just ricochets around the country and gets in the way of good information that needs to be followed. This is a strange time indeed.
It is. And early on, when I was talking to the governor at one of his briefings, we kept talking about social distancing, and I said, shouldn't we also have social media distancing? And he thought that might be a pretty good idea.
Well, July 31st is a pretty important date for lots of people, millions of people in the United States and thousands in North Dakota, Dave, because that $600 additional jobless benefit expires today.
Right. And the House and Senate, the Congress, has not been able to come to an agreement on it. The Senate wants to go down to $200. The House wants to stay at $600. And the spending in the replacement bill for the CARES Act, the House is proposing $3 trillion. The Senate's proposing $1 trillion. And now they're leaving for the weekend, and there's a lot of things still in the air.
Yes, the dithering in Congress is also concerning. And we've got the concern that's coming up with the loss of this additional income and other jobless benefits, you know, easing out of the way. Evictions and foreclosures are likely to go up and perhaps even spike. That's got lawmakers and policymakers pretty concerned as well.
That's right. You know, there is a rent bridge program that's offered by the state, but that will only pay so much on your rent. And there is a real worry that if you don't get, you know, back to something like $600, a lot of people will be out on the streets.
Well, let's talk about education, because that's on a lot of people's minds right now, with schools poised to reopen at the end of August or after Labor Day in many cases. The School Boards Association has been meeting, Dave, and they're concerned, obviously, because once all those kids come together, that raises the risk.
That's right. And you talk about the school boards, the state organization, it's basically going to be district by district, and you're seeing districts take a lot of approaches to this. A number of districts have asked parents and others in the community, as well as teachers, staff, school board members, to really weigh in and to see what could be accomplished under several scenarios. One scenario they're talking about initially was a yes, full contact. X would be maybe all online, and Z might be, you know, some kind of hybrid of that. And I know Bismarck schools have looked at those three kind of categories, but Fargo's gotten a little bit more complicated.
They have. As a matter of fact, Steve, yesterday in your paper, C.S. Hagen wrote a very long article about the Fargo Public Schools Smart Restart Plan and the various philosophies they sorted through, and they came up with like an 82-page document that talks about level 1 through 5. It's very comprehensive.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of the district has done a lot to gather input from parents and from staff and teachers. You know, they came up with this 82-page plan. They spent 7 hours discussing it yesterday. The reporter C.S. Hagen, he did a pretty good job of really trying to boil it down in the discussions that were going on with that. Essentially, they've got like 5 different risk levels and pretty detailed plans on what happens at each one of those, but still really no clarity on which risk level they start at. So you know, a lot of unknowns. They've done a ton of planning, but there's still so much that's unknown. And I think in the end, flexibility is probably going to be key for everyone on this issue.
Well, they mentioned that, of course, if everybody were to go back to school, I think Jim Johnson, a board member of the school board, said that the average interchange between students every day is about 500 classmates. So that's the kind of contact that they're concerned about. Robin, do you still have a student in school?
I don't. Well, I have 2 students in college. So one will be at NDSU and the other at University of South Dakota in Vermilion. And from what I know, they will be wearing masks in all of their classes. I think a lot of those classes have or some anyway, will be online only, but there will be some face-to-face class time. But so no, not in the Fargo Public Schools anymore, but this is quite a situation. One thing that kind of stands out to me too is this concept of guided practice centers where they're going to have, you know, they want the younger kids, the elementary age kids, to get more face-to-face time because this online stuff is just really tough, you know, when you're that young to be able to learn that way, and you need more help from a parent and such. And so they're going to be using middle and high schools for elementary students to be sort of more spread out and to be able to get that face-to-face time. So, I mean, I cannot think of a time when anything like this has occurred.
I can't either. And I was intrigued by the thoughtfulness, I think, of the Fargo School Board raising that special concern about students of that age, because they do want that more in-person kind of classes for elementary grades, fewer face-to-face for middle and high school grades, because they can be perhaps trusted to be a little more self-motivated. Whatever, though, I was truly intrigued by the contrast, if you will, between the Fargo Public Schools and the Bismarck Public Schools. Now, the Fargo School Board voted 7-2 for this complex five-level plan. Bismarck voted unanimously to send students back to school, full-time in-person instruction when school opens. I think that's the end of August. So that's a different point of view. Obviously, there's tremendous concern, Steve, about the kind of the lack of the concern about the quality of education that was sacrificed due to COVID-19 in the spring when everybody was at home. And the concern about, you know, whether educational levels will have been reached and retained.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there was a lot of discussion early on in March and April. We saw the schools close and parents having to adjust to a new schedule and figuring out how to balance working remotely, making sure their children get educated. And, you know, we're 3-4 months along down the road, and there's still a lot of ambiguity, but a lot of concern, I believe, and you're seeing different districts take these different approaches. West Fargo had a news conference today, so I think there is a lot of concern. I mean, parents know their children the best and sort of how they learn, and not everybody learns the same, so this will, again, test a lot of people to really figure out what the best plan is for each student. One of the things that I think is interesting in most of the districts that I've seen as far as their plan so far is that they are at least providing an option for those who don't feel comfortable sending their children back to the classroom to do so. But, of course, that, especially if they're working parents, that adds another layer of complexity to it.
And they have to make that decision by 4 o'clock today. Today's the deadline for whether or not they do distance learning for 9 weeks or until the end of a grading period. So this is a commitment that they would have to make. And it sounds like it's a tough decision for a lot of people.
It's interesting with the Bismarck school's approach, you know, unanimously saying they're going to do in-person learning. They do also say, though, that, you know, COVID is still going to, the prevalence of it is still going to determine what kind of instruction happens. So one could assume that behind the scenes they are planning for that. And, you know, Fargo's got theirs kind of out front with everybody and all of the details. So one would hope that is taking place in Bismarck as well, at least what to do if things really explode further.
Well, forum reporter Michelle Griffith wrote the story that was covering the Bismarck school board decision-making process, and she quotes Superintendent Jason Hornbacher as saying, it's not a matter of if the plan will change, but when the plan will change.
Right.
That they do anticipate, you know, and they should anticipate that somebody's going to come down with this.
Well, and the one thing that I see as a thread a little bit through both Fargo and Bismarck is having these task forces who kind of evaluate the situation, but and they're going to meet every weeks. And, you know, 2 weeks is a long time in the matter of COVID and planning. I mean, we've seen the numbers in Bismarck and Burleigh County kind of lead the state here for several days, or if not weeks. But, you know, they're in on an enviable position, I think, in trying to come up with these plans to really have details that is workable for all families. But it is this is the time we live in. It's very interesting.
Dave, in your school board's association story, the State School Board Association yesterday, you were quoting this Alexis Baxley, the executive director of the School Boards Association, saying that, you know, mask issues, of course, will be important. And then she asks, are teachers going to feel comfortable? And I talked about this with Nick Archuleta, North Dakota United president, a week or so ago. And he's saying that is a big issue, especially with older teachers or teachers with underlying conditions.
Right.
Are they being put in the front line of a highly risky situation?
And that's why they're talking about things like masks. They're talking about definite social distancing. They're talking about maybe even putting plexiglass in front of teachers' desks. And maybe even, and I know that the university system's really looking at this, maybe having microphones and amplified sound so that instructors can reach their students a little bit better. There's a lot of things that are at play here. And, of course, you know, with Burleigh and Morton starting their own task force, as Steve mentioned, they'll be keeping a really close watch at those numbers. And especially since the last thing, which I found very interesting, that the spike in the numbers in Burleigh and Morton is among 20 to 30-year-olds.
Yeah.
Which kind of, that puts a hole in some narratives.
The other issue here that we need to remember, and I think Robin referenced this as well, is that when school is in session and things are normal and kids are going to school and parents go to work, you don't have this childcare complication if they're not going to school. They're at home. And, you know, if you do have a job, and we talked about jobless benefits for those who don't, if you do have a job, getting child care right now has to be as hard as it's ever been.
I've been hearing a lot about child care shortages and concerns about child care centers have not reopened in Bismarck and also in Fargo. I'm not really sure, and that might be worth more investigation into how prevalent that is and what the availability is of child care. I know there's been some incentives from the state to help child cares reopen, but you still have to kind of limit who is allowed in a child care center and how much interaction there is, and you do social distancing. There are a lot of dominoes in this. Let's put it that way.
Well, you mentioned those 20 and 30-year-olds who were spiking in the Bismarck-Mandan area in terms of the COVID-19 infections that are showing up. Of course, we're heading toward that, as Robin mentioned, the universities are going to be opening up, too, later in August. And already, I know they're talking about using masks. NDSU and UND are requiring masks to be worn when students, faculty, and staff are indoors or in places where social distancing is not possible. And we've heard about these plexiglass screens that have been put up in UND classrooms, Dave, and having microphones and speakers, you know, to make sure everybody can still hear it if they're in the classroom, because they can opt to take things online as well. So higher education has been severely disrupted as well.
Absolutely. And you talk about things, and we didn't mention this, but in universities, you're going to see a limited space in dormitories. Instead of having like two people per room, it's going to be one person per room. And maybe they're going to have to open up more dormitory space and things like that. Classrooms are going to be limited. And what I find, and you know, as an old UND graduate, I'm very familiar with the Chester Fritz Auditorium. Then may you be using Chester Fritz, which I think seats 3,000 people, to do some of the larger lectures, because you can easily have, you know, social distancing there.
And UND Medical School Dean Joshua Wynn, in your story, Dave, earlier this week, or last week, I guess, last Friday, had told the Board of Higher Education that his hope is to have every student tested before they come on campus. And then when they leave campus and return, or when athletic teams leave and return, wow.
There's going to be a lot of testing. He's already talking about that the health department's on board with it and ramping up these testing events or facilities or whatever you want to call it. He said he wants to make sure that people are safe.
Well, one of the issues here with this testing is how quickly the test results come in. My significant other had a test on Monday at Community Health in downtown Fargo and is still waiting for the result. And it would seem to be that the more days between the test and the result, the more problematic the test is to start with.
I think you're right on that. And I know that, you know, it's a case of capacity to get these tests processed. The state health department says the state lab is running 24/7, 365 with three different shifts. But that's not going to handle all the tests. So now they're looking at places like Sanford, places maybe like Altru or UND and NDSU to help with testing. And I've been hearing that they're ramping up to help.
I went through a similar situation a few weeks ago and went to get tested, and it took 5 days. Shortly after that, we had a story about Sanford, and they have a hard time keeping up with the testing need as well, and started farming out some of the lower risk or less symptomatic folks, which is what was driving the time, the length of getting those test results back. So, you know, there's a lot of testing being done, but there's obviously still an issue of giving that, getting them back in a timely manner.
Well, let's move on to the Spirit Lake Tribe mandating masks and a curfew because COVID-19 is spreading on that reservation. I did not realize that that had turned into a hotspot.
I was unaware of that, too, until Jeremy Turley's story on that. But there is concern. Spirit Lake is concerned. Also, Standing Rock is concerned. Three affiliated tribes up at Newtown, they're concerned as well. And they're really trying to ramp up testing as much as they can.
Well, I know that they hope to learn more about the reservation's outbreak through a mass testing event that is slated for today at Kandeska Chicana Community College in Fort Totten. So they are concerned. I think it was 60 new cases in the last couple of weeks. That would be quite a few for a place the size of the reservation and the population of Benson County, which was about 7,000, according to that story by Turley.
And Jeremy's story yesterday, the 60 cases, there were 12 more reported today, too. So, I wasn't aware of the outbreak there, but that's definitely a story worth following.
That's Steve Wagner. He's the director of the Forum News Service, and we also have with us today Robin Huebner, investigative and enterprise reporter at Forum Communications and WDAY-TV, and then our own Prairie Public News director, Dave Thompson. We'll have more of our journalist roundtable after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Some Minnesota school leaders are showing their appreciation for the back-to-school guidance unveiled by the Walz administration. They called it a tailored, data-driven approach, and they say it will help guide their planning as the school year nears. David Law is the superintendent of the Anoka-Hennepin School District.
I appreciate the intent of the plan. I think that it's trying to be based on real-time numbers, and it's trying to give flexibility to different levels of infection across the state. There's just a lot of work we have to do in the next 5 weeks to interpret it and do it well.
It may be a few weeks before parents will get the plan from their local districts. North Dakota Senator Kevin Cramer says President Trump is correct to be concerned about reliance on mail-in voting in the November election. Cramer appeared on the Fox Business Network this morning.
If we have a mandatory mail-in voting, it is ripe for opportunity for mischief and fraud, especially in states like California that do ballot harvesting. Having multiple people, in the supply chain of voting just makes zero sense whatsoever. So I think he's right. We ought to have, in-person voting for the most part, stick to that tradition.
Cramer suggested there could be some other modifications to the voting process based on the COVID-19 pandemic.
I had a smart North Dakotan yesterday suggest that maybe instead of having one day, let's have three election days back to back to back, but slow down the process, allow for social distancing, but still encourage people to vote in person.
In a tweet, President Trump suggested delaying the November election. And North Dakota currently has 166 electric vehicles and 193 plug-in hybrid electric vehicles registered with the North Dakota's Transportation Department. DOT Director of Transportation Program Steve Solway gave that update to the legislature's Interim Agriculture and Transportation Committee, which is studying the growth of electric vehicles and the charging infrastructure.
Currently, there are 29 Level 2 electric charging stations in North Dakota. There are 32 Tesla superchargers at four locations, eight each at Bismarck, Dickinson, Jamestown, and Fargo, with an additional 14 stations planned, six in Grand Forks and eight in Pembina.
Solway said in January, North Dakota's Department of Environmental Quality funded the first round of applications from the Volkswagen settlement money for 17 Level 3 fast charging stations in 10 communities across the state.
The locations that received the Level 3 grants were five in Fargo, two in Bismarck, two in Minot, two in Grand Forks, and then one each in Coal Harbor, Dickinson, Williston, Grafton, Hillsboro, and Wahpeton.
Solway said those will come online in the fall or early next year. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, introducing the North Dakota recipients of the 2020 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2020 Bush Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. It's our Journalist Roundtable to round out the month of July, today being the last day. And our Journalist Roundtable always includes our own news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, always a pleasure to have you with us on this fine day.
Thank you, Doug.
And Steve Wagner joins us. He's the director of the Forum News Service. And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
And my old colleague, Robin Huebner, who's investigative and enterprise reporter at Forum Communications and WDAY-TV. Always a pleasure to hear your voice, Robin.
My pleasure to be involved. Thanks, Doug.
Let's start with a provocative column written by Forum commentator Rob Port that was published in today's Forum, and that has to do with the headline, "Who is Worse, Anti-LGBT Republicans or Those Who Tolerate Them?" Pretty provocative, coming from the same side of the political divide.
You know, I've been talking to a lot of people about this whole thing. And, of course, nobody can tell you who authored it or wants to tell you who authored it. But, you know, they point to the party saying they disavowed that. I think it was number 31 in terms of the planks of the platform. But I hear from people, Republican officials in both Fargo and Grand Forks, both college towns, of course, that they're worried that this kind of resolution is not going to be good for the party when it comes to legislative races. And I think that's one to watch, especially in Fargo and Grand Forks.
Well, I noted that the state's congressional delegation and the governor of the state, Doug Burgum, all just came out guns blazing against this. They wanted to stand firmly opposed to the platform statements. And Chairman Rick Berg also said he regretted that the fact that this had gotten in there. John Trandum, who's been outspoken on this issue for years and referred to the fact that it's been in the platform essentially like that since 2016, is the first vice chair of the North Dakota Republican Party, and he voted against publicly disavowing those statements. So there is evidence, I guess, of a strong difference of opinion about that within the party. And when it comes to platform statements, it's not like people have to run on them, but it is like it's a statement about the party's general position and advocacy for things. And I was intrigued by Port's quote from a lawmaker who said, "First, most don't want to get involved because, quite frankly, out west, it doesn't get much traction with the general public. It's a much bigger deal out in the valley." I was intrigued by that.
Certainly this kind of language is not going to fly among younger voters. I mean, I talked to my kids who are of voting age, and the language that was in the document, which was describing LGBT practices as unhealthy and dangerous and suggested that gay or transgender people may be unsafe to have around children. When I talk to my kids, it's not a big deal to them. It's life. It's accepted, and people are people, and that could present a difficulty for some of these candidates going forward if that's the way they truly feel.
And maybe we have reached a point in our evolution as a society and in the 21st century and our political growth that certain social issues, which were raw meat in previous political cycles, are less palatable now.
Yes, and if I could add one thing to the discussion that I think you're also seeing emerge, there seems to be a number of factions in the Republican Party. And as you might expect, you know, that the Republicans have been in control, and sometimes these things develop. For example, you've got the Libertarian wing of the party, and they want to, you know, kind of flex their muscles a little bit on that. And they've actually gone so far as to take a look at being declared as a minority caucus in the upcoming legislative session. I don't know if that's going to go very far because, you know, this could be a very contentious legislative session coming up, given the fact that the money supply might be limited. So these issues tend to, you know, kind of bubble under the surface more or less, and they finally are coming out in the open a little bit, and you're seeing some scabs being pulled off in the party.
Well, as we've talked about many times, Dave, the supermajority of the Republicans in North Dakota does create friction because you get to a certain size and people start, you know, moving to a different cloakroom maybe to have the
right.
Bastiat caucus or
it's
whatever.
The Bastiats, yes. The Libertarians, of course, is, you know, that's more the Libertarian wing.
So we'll see whether or not any of this bubbles up during the legislative session. We certainly know where the governor stands on it and some other prominent Republicans in the state, so that's intriguing. Let's move on to another story here, and this was in the Grand Forks Herald, which is another foreign communications paper, and it was headlined, and I was shocked by this, Steve. Early estimates show 2.5 million acres of North Dakota's cropland wasn't planted this year. That's amazing to me.
That's a staggering number. You know, and I, reading the story that Ann Bailey wrote, that's almost three times the number of acres last year, which was the 10th highest in the U.S. So it is a staggering number. We did have a really wet winter and spring. You know, of course, to add on top of this, we've had a lot of moisture in the last month even. So, but the unplanted cropland is a staggering number.
Well, I have seen the reports that northeastern North Dakota and northwest Minnesota, for that matter, have had too much water, standing water. It's really destroyed entire fields in some cases. But that number, 2.5 million acres of farmland, compares with Minnesota last year, which had 1.2 million prevented planted acres, and it ranked sixth in the nation. That's more than twice that number. And that's got to hit the state's bottom line again, Dave. Ag and oil have been hard hit.
It's been very hard hit. And the contrast is to me is just really interesting that especially in the eastern third of the state, you've got a lot of water. But if you look at an area around Bismarck-Mandan right now, it's actually in a moderate drought, which is extremely interesting to me. Parts of or surrounding the Bismarck-Mandan area are abnormally dry, but the further east you go, the wetter it gets. And I'm beginning to ask, and I'm just asking the question because I don't know for sure, but remember a lot of crops remained in the field because they had wet conditions, snow conditions, and they couldn't get the crops out before the freeze. Is some of this land still, you know, being harvested at this point, and can they get to it?
I was remembering when I flew out of Fargo in January, looking down at all the corn that was still in fields around Fargo-Moorhead.
Yeah.
Let's move on to another issue that was intriguing. I just saw this the last couple of days, and I thought, what is this about? Dave, you reported on it. I know Steve and Robin, you've probably seen this too. But some North Dakotans have received strange seed packages.
Yeah, it looks like they may be coming from China. And some of the packages are labeled as jewels or gems. It's interesting. But you open it and these seeds, well, nobody really knows what the seeds are. But, you know, there could be noxious weeds or may have something in them. But everybody's saying don't plant them, send them to the state agriculture department. They're going to send them to NDSU Extension to have a look, go through the laboratories and see what's actually these seeds are. But I mean, 40 people so far at least have reported that they've received these packets in the mail. Where is it coming from and how are they getting it to these people?
I noticed that Minnesota's been reporting on it too.
And these are all unsolicited, obviously.
Right.
This just shows up in the mailbox, something that they obviously did not order. Is there any thought on what actually the seeds are? I mean, what are the experts saying?
Well, Goring believes that some of the seeds might be noxious or, you know, invasive weed species, or maybe just, you know, feed for chickens, things like that. He said they're all over the place, and it's just hard to tell if there is a rhyme or reason to this, if what is going on there. There have been a lot of theories that have been floated in social media again about what might be happening. But he said that the only way we're going to find out anything is if we start testing these things and see if there, you know, might be pathogens that might be attached to them.
Your story, Dave, wasn't the first time I'd seen it. I'd seen it on social media, but it got me thinking too, because of a couple of the comments that the Ag Commissioner provided, and you know, just even that we don't know if it's harmful to other plants, animals, or humans. You know, simply opening up the package, I mean, is it going to be, you know, so the amount of work and effort that goes into just identifying what these are and the controls that they probably have to have in place to do it. It's such a bizarre story.
It really is. It really is.
Well, you hope if anybody did open it and planted it, it was indoors. At any rate, more to come on that story. Let's end with the state of athletics. You know, high school and college athletics have been totally disrupted. Professional athletics have been totally disrupted. Concordia College is moving most fall sports to the spring. Minnesota State University's NSIC conference has reduced games. North Dakota State and UND have lost games, and of course, still up in the air as to whether those conferences will actually complete. 6 of the 13 conferences in the football championship series have already canceled. So this is an important month, I guess, for college athletics and, for that matter, high school, too. And who would have thought this?
Exactly.
Yeah, it feels a little bit like things felt in March, where it was just kind of a domino effect, where you heard of one thing being canceled and then another, and thinking, well, this is still going to happen. This is no, and then that eventually went by the wayside too. So, I hope that is not the case. I really do hope that athletes are able to get some of their seasons in, no matter what it is. But it's just, you see what's happening in Major League Baseball with, you know, they're back at it and games being postponed because cases just keep popping up. I just don't know how it's going to turn out.
Yeah, they're playing in empty stadiums with piped in fan sounds, you know, like cheers and stuff like that. It's eerie. Dom Izzo, Steve, had a story that was posted yesterday that the Bison are going to add cloth face masks to the football helmet to help prevent COVID-19 spread if they actually do play a game.
Yeah, and no, that's really interesting. You know, of course, their conference said that they are, at least currently, they're going to go forward with interconference games, but the schools have lost a lot of their other non-conference games, and NDSU is, you know, sort of on the forefront there again, with trying to come up with a plan that will work to salvage their season. And so, you know, they're working with this group out of Texas that previously branded products, but now they're making them. And several of the other Missouri Valley football teams are working on a similar plan to what the Bison are doing, in hopes of keeping a season.
And next Tuesday, the NCAA Board of Governors will meet and could determine to either cancel or postpone the fall championships, which would include the FCS playoffs, which the Bison have dominated for years. So more to come on that. Well, we've run out of time for our Journalists' Roundtable. As always, Robin Huebner, investigative and enterprise reporter at Forum Communications and WDAY-TV, thanks for being with us today.
It was great to talk to all of you.
Steve Wagner is Director of Forum News Service. Thank you for being with us, Steve.
Thank you.
And Dave, it's a pleasure to talk with you every week. Dave is Prairie Public's News Director.
Thank you, Doug.
Coming up on Main Street, a movie review from Matt O'Lean.
African Soul, American Heart protects orphan girls from South Sudan from forced marriage by keeping them in school until they're adults and able to make their own choices about their futures. Learn more at asahinsudan.org.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt O'Lean. And Matt, this week you're talking about a movie I've never heard of, First Cow.
Well, it's a very interesting movie, Doug, directed by Kelly Reichert. And she is really a director, Doug, that has carved out her own niche in American cinema with films like Certain Women, Wendy and Lucy, Old Joy. Very minimalist filmmaking. You almost watch her films and feel like, is she losing any lighting? Is there are these real actors? Things like that. So very minimalist style. Certain Women is my favorite of her movies. This is on Prime Video right now. Again, like a lot of movies, Doug, theaters are not open. I don't know when they're going to be open because there's no product to show and things continue to be pushed back with premieres. So we may be in this for the long haul in terms of Oscar-nominated films that haven't even appeared in a theater. First Cow is a very interesting film with great period detail. It takes place in the 1820s, Doug, kind of in the northwest part of the United States at that time, and everybody's going to California to strike gold. And there's a guy named Cookie, played by John Magaro, and he is with some travelers, and he acts as kind of the chef, the cook, but he's not satisfied. And eventually he meets the actor Orion Lee, who plays King Lu, and he is a Chinese immigrant who's come to America to kind of seek his fortune and sell tea and make biscuits and things like this, and they become partners. And they become partners in a very unusual way, Doug, because they end up finding this cow, and they milk it, and that cow's milk, they're able to make these biscuits that are delicious, and they sell them. And that is their big money-making scheme. But, of course, the cow is owned by someone, and that's about all I can say. That's where things go from there. So very interesting plot, a film subject I really have never seen before, very unusual with this cow. But the period detail reminded me of McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Doug. It's so minimalist. And so this is a very interesting time in history, Doug. People moving west, 1840s, northwest, people going to California for the gold rush. That's talked about in this movie, you know, heading south to California to make their fortune. But as I said, they concoct this money-making scheme, but it's totally dependent on a cow. And that's the interesting part of it. But getting back to the period detail, it reminded me of McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Remember, Doug, that was like when Robert Altman sort of demystified the West, and you felt dirty watching that movie. The bars were dirty.
Yeah.
Everyone, you know, wore big fur coats, and it was just a grim time. And that's the feeling you get watching this movie. The period detail is great. I thought it was a little long at 2 hours, and there's not a ton of suspense. But it's really a film about brotherhood and two people from completely different backgrounds who kind of come together to be friends and partners.
Well, it's interesting that it's on Amazon Prime because I'm watching an awful lot of stuff on streaming services, and Amazon Prime is pretty good, actually. But this movie, I believe, started in film festivals. Is that how it got to Prime?
Yes, it did. And now, because of it being released on Prime, it is now eligible for any kind of 2020 Oscars. And we've talked about that a lot, Doug, about how this is going to be a very strange Oscar year for sure, as the eligibility requirements even get into January and February. Critics have loved this film. I liked it a lot. Didn't love it completely. Like I said, it's a little too long. I didn't feel the suspense, but the period detail, the cinematography, the two lead performances by John Magaro and Orion Lee make this a film that I think people will enjoy. And it does start slow. So if you are watching at home, give it 10 or 15 minutes to get into it and see where this is going.
I was intrigued when you said you were going to review this film because, of course, I hadn't heard of it. I went up to IMDb and read a bit about it, and I discovered that Kelly Reichert also co-wrote the screenplay mm-hmm. with Jonathan Raymond, who had written the book about yeah. this story, this novel. And it's intriguing that we're seeing, from these kinds of movies, we see a whole different kind of story being told. I mean, it's not the traditional Hollywood arc that we see. It's a different kind of an intriguing piece of history, a different story.
It is. And think back, Doug, to maybe films you saw as a kid, Spencer Tracy, you know, Northwest Rangers or whatever that was called, and everyone looks clean. They look bathed. Yeah. Their teeth look great. This is like, you know, 1810s, 1820s frontier life. And that is not what it looks like here. And we've seen that through the years in movie making, Doug, where filmmakers have, you know, it's not like they don't love old Hollywood movies, but there's a move toward realism. And that is what you feel with this film. That's the big selling point of this movie, I think, is the realism and the bonding of the two characters. That's why I would recommend it. I do like Certain Women better. That was Kelly Reichert's most recent film, which is like a multiple plot film with a lot of good actresses and actors in there. But this is right up there. I did enjoy this a lot. It's not going to be for everyone. It's one of those films. If you look on Rotten Tomatoes, Doug, the critics like it better than the audience.
All right. Well, I am going to look it up and I'm going to check it out. Thanks for making me aware of First Cow. That sort of prompted my Oscar trivia question this week because I thought, well, why don't we talk about low-budget movies that did pretty well? And I've got one that I think is a pretty tough question. What is the lowest budget movie in dollars for the time it was made
okay.
to win Best Picture?
Wow. Is it Marty?
It's actually pretty recent.
It's pretty recent.
The woman who produced it became the first woman to win Best Picture twice.
The Hurt Locker. No. It's not The Hurt Locker. First woman to win Best Picture twice.
The first picture was 12 Years a Slave in 2014.
Oh. Okay. So the second one would have been Moonlight.
That is correct.
Okay. Yeah. That was a small budget. Yeah.
It was made for $1.5 million in 2016. Now, that was the lowest budget since Rocky won Best Picture in 76 at $1.1 million, but that was in 1976 dollars. So
right.
This $1.5 million would have been a real rock-bottom movie to win Best Picture.
That's a good question, Doug.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
What's the most mundane but thunderous epiphany you've ever had?
Similes using fart as a comparison are abundant in English.
Just hold still a minute now. You're like a fart in a mitten.
Hey, buddy, we're sharing here. Don't monopolize. Dude, don't Bogart's addressing.
Join us this week on Away with Words.
Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 31st. On this date in 1900, they issued an arrest warrant for Joseph Schlanzer of Fargo for the murder of A.P. Carroll. The murder weapon was Schlanzer's teeth, and the fatal injury, a bitten thumb. Cause of death was blood poisoning. Schlanzer of Fargo was a veteran of the Spanish-American War and a carpenter. Carroll was from France, went to seminary there, but came to the United States around 1890 and had only been in Fargo for a few months, and was a cook for the restaurant at the Northern Pacific Depot. The thumb-biting incident happened in the night of July 17, 1900. After work, Carroll went for a walk, crossing the bridge from Fargo to Moorhead. Now, there are conflicting reports of what happened next. According to Carroll, he witnessed an inebriated Schlanzer knock over a little girl riding a bicycle. The girl's father hit Schlanzer. Carroll said, "Serves him right." An angered Schlanzer then struck Carroll. When Carroll raised his arm in defense, Schlanzer bit the tip of his thumb off. Carroll ran back to work, where his colleagues said he should go to the hospital. A doctor amputated part of Carroll's thumb, but despite the medical care, Carroll came down with a fever and infection and died on July 26th. While on his deathbed, he told a priest that Schlosser should not get in trouble for what happened, and he took the blame for the incident. According to other witnesses, the thumb biting came about differently. They said a very drunk, that part was the same, Schlosser, was walking outside of the Arcade Saloon in Moorhead and picking fights. After fighting two men, he next attacked Carroll and bit his thumb. After Carroll ran off, witnesses found the bit of thumb on the ground and put it in a glass of alcohol. When Schlosser was interrogated about the incident, he claimed he had been drinking all night and did not remember the event. He said he did not attack Carroll, but also he could not swear that he didn't do it. A grand jury heard the case, but then dismissed it. After all, Carroll's deathbed wish was for Schlosser to not be prosecuted. Schlosser and his family attended Carroll's funeral. It's not known if he continued to make a habit of biting people. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Trista Razor-Stursa. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Listen to NPR News at work, even if you're working in your slippers. Ask your smart speaker to play NPR and stay connected at home.
You've got not one, but two streams of Prairie Public to choose from on your smart speaker. Just ask it and listen.
A teenage daughter desperately tries to help her wrongfully convicted father who's on death row. That's the premise of the debut novel, This Is My America by Kim Johnson.
I wanted to write a story that would showcase that in the generational impact, because this does impact so many Black and brown families.
Also, once there's a coronavirus vaccine, how do you convince reluctant people to get it? Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. And as I always remind you, as we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, so you can listen to us more than one way. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street program at prairiepublic.org. Monday on our show, Yellowstone Public Radio's Stella Fong will talk about her newest cookbook, Flavors Under the Big Sky. It pays tribute to her Chinese-American heritage. We'll have a natural North Dakota essay from Chuck Lura. And we'll visit with Terry Burns of Project Renew. It's a free crisis counseling program established by Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota in response to the COVID-19 crisis. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.